Hello everyone, Barney here. Welcome to Loco Ludus. This episode is another interview. How wonderful. I so wish that I could put out episodes more often than once a month, but at the moment there's so much going on that it's just not possible. Now, when I say so much going on, I do mean gaming stuff. So just that time in that I have is filled up with other stuff, and I'm not going to talk about that here. I so wish that this was the moment, but it's not, because as I said, it's another interview today, and that of course is what we're focusing on. And it's an interview with Eric Savitsky, the editor and designer of Filmmakers Without Cameras, a journal which is just going into its second issue. That second issue is live now on Kickstarter, so it's got hopefully about 3 days left when you hear this, maybe two, something like that. And I hope very much that this conversation that Eric and I have inspires you to support the project. Eric and I cover a lot of ground, ranging from games to politics to films, of course, as the title of the journal suggests. And it was a really enjoyable conversation, because Eric, I think, has a similar kind of speed of talking to me. It's different, but there's a similarity there. And listening back to the recording really just emphasised that for me. And I think that was really a significant element in the pleasure of the exchange that we have, and the synergies in our thoughts and experiences with things. Now then, what else can I say? We talk about crowdfunding. We talk about professional GMing. So, you know, how to have a healthy relationship to money in the hobby is a topic, and that was really nice to have. I also get the impression from some of the things that Eric says that his partner is quite involved in Filmmakers Without Cameras, but wants to remain quiet or anonymous in that process, I think. I could be wrong, but I'm very interested to, in future, hear more about that working relationship, perhaps. I do think Eric is a very interesting chap, and so I do think that he's going to be doing things for a good while to come, and that is wonderful. So I think that's probably about it. I do hope that you enjoy the discussion that we have, and I will hopefully be back soon with another episode before too long. All the best. Bye-bye. Hi, Eric. It's great to have you on the show.
And thanks for having me, buddy.
Regular listeners know that I like to start off with a few left field questions, just to kind of read your being at this moment. So I've managed to extract a few from some depths of my mind here. I'm going to start off with something like this. If you could be one of your role-play game characters, and you had to go to a job interview. What soap would you smell of?
God, that is a left field question.
I'll accept like aftershave or eau de toilette, or even, you know, like a particularly potent shampoo or conditioner, something like that, you know.
I mean, one of my favorite characters that I ever played was this really hammy barbarian bard multiclass. Druid. He was a barbarian druid who just chatted shit all the time. You know, like you'd ask him a question, he'd never tell the truth. Mm-hmm. But by his nature of being a, you know, druid barbarian, I think whatever he wore would be something really strong, something earthy and woody. Mm. You know, there's like car air fresheners you get that are like pine woods. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he just come like with those hanging off his arms.
Nice. So really, really that kind of almost like the smell of hiding something.
Mm, absolutely.
Love it. Fantastic. And of course, you know, we can all imagine a wide range of those kind of air fresheners, can't we? But yes, I take your point with a kind of a woodland scent, a pine scent. Super. Okay. You've got a surprise Christmas number one.
Mm-hmm.
You don't quite know how it happened, and it's got an RPG theme.
Mm-hmm.
Have you got any idea what it would hone in on in terms of the hobby? You know, like what would it be called, and what would your, you know, band be called, maybe, or what would the vibe of the band be?
Mm-hmm. I've been playing a lot of Scum and Villainy recently, which runs off the Forged in the Dark system. If you play like Blades in the Dark, and so my mind immediately went to Time by Pink Floyd. Because of the clocks, because my side of the screen usually just ends up being an absolute mess of clocks for everything. But in terms of name, I suppose Time by Pink Floyd would be a funny number one for Christmas. But in band name, I'm terrible at these kinds of questions.
You're doing fine. You're doing absolutely fine. I mean, so you're thinking of a cover version of Time, which has been given some kind of RPG makeover.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it could be like a Scum and Villainy. So it would be in that context they might be like futuristic clocks. So it would have a different, you know, tone to it than
very synth heavy cover of Time.
Mm.
I wonder if somebody's made something like that actually.
There's got to be someone. is it on general release? That's the thing. Okay, here we go. Last one. This is the last one. It's the home stretch. You are designing a realm of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
Could you give us an indication of a color scheme for it?
Ooh, I've been to watch The Green Knight just this morning, actually, and I love. I've been kind of getting into the OSR recently as well. Mm-hmm. And so I really love that low fantasy medieval Europe setting.
Mm-hmm.
And so the royal yellows and the greens and the blues of skies.
Mm-hmm.
I think I know this is the most generic fantasy color scheme you can think of. But I think actually I was speaking to my partner recently and we were talking about our kind of desert island discs.
Mm.
And there's an album by M83 called Digital Sounds Volume 2.
Okay.
Which kind of really boils down what I think what fantasy sounds like, but it's an entirely synth-made album.
Okay.
And it has this really striking light, like a baby pink cover of somebody riding a dinosaur, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think, yeah, I think a baby pink as well, somewhere in there.
A baby pink, absolutely. Nice. Very nice. And would you, if there was a texture to those colours, would they be kind of woven or kind of airbrushed, or would you go for hard block colours? Mm.
I've got the Disco Elysium poster right behind me. Mm. And it has that kind of pastely.
Mm.
What's the art style called? Oh, it's completely escaped me. But yeah, pastels, I think.
Pastels.
Yeah. Gritty pastels.
Gritty pastels. Excellent. Nice. Nice. Super. Okay. So the reason that you're on talking today is because you have issue 2 of Filmmakers Without Cameras.
Mm-hmm.
Which is currently on Kickstarter. And this is a fascinating project, I think, because I'm really interested in Paris cinema, or I've even some people talk about unfilmable scenarios. So kind of taking these filmic elements and twisting them, applying them in different formats.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really, really interested to hear from you how you came up with this idea for Filmmakers Without Cameras, which, if you didn't get it from the title, has a strong gaming thread in it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I'm really interested in that combination and how that came into being and ultimately where you see it going. But mm-hmm. but you know, that might be later. So I mean, how did it all start?
I mean, the out of necessity, really. I only started last year when I was
necessity.
Furloughed.
Necessity. Yeah. Amazing.
I was furloughed last year mm-hmm. when the pandemic hit, and that meant that I was just sitting in my bedroom. And it's bizarre to think about it now, because we didn't know anything about COVID at that time. So it was like, we got a takeaway and you would like move the pizza out of the box and dispose of the box, burn it immediately, you know, and just have zero contact with the outside world. And so that meant that me and my partner, who we'd only met about 4 months before that. And she lived up in Dundee and I lived in Leeds. So we made this like a snap decision to move in together. So yeah, I got furloughed and we were sitting inside with nothing to do basically all day. And I saw a job posting that required 3 things. It was about it. The closing date was 2 months in the future. And it required that you knew basics of HTML and CSS, and InDesign.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, I've got 2 months to teach myself HTML and InDesign.
Wow.
And I built about my website, and I wasn't really like, I enjoyed it, but it wasn't fulfilling. But InDesign was where I sat down and I really thought, okay, this is really quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the contributors in issue 1 are my neighbors, because it just so happened that the block I was living in was full of like young professionals and art school students.
Yeah.
And so I got talking to them. There were a lot of illustrators and I had these conversations of like, yeah, it'd be cool to do something. And, you know, we just do a little print run, do it for charity, raise some money. But we ended up raising over £1,000
mm-hmm.
from the first issue. And I thought, okay, if I will just pay you for your contribution. And if you want to donate that to charity, that's up to you. But, you know, a lot of these people, obviously, because of the pandemic, didn't have jobs or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up paying people, you know, a fairly decent rate,
mm-hmm.
I think. So that's how it started. Mm. But the kind of, as an idea, I went to film school.
Mm-hmm.
I studied film. purely because I had, you know, when I was a teenager, you make these silly decisions. I thought, I'll go to film school because I want to work as a video game developer in the future.
Oh, I went to film school because I thought I like writing and art.
Mm. And it was the visuals for me.
Mm.
And I wrote my dissertation on the kind of comparison of storytelling in video games and cinema,
mm-hmm.
with the kind of final point that we should not be trying to make video games, or we should not be celebrating video games for their adherence to
mm-hmm.
cinema. Mm-hmm. Because you see a lot of video games right now being like, oh, you know, this cutscene made me cry. That's a very kind of strong opinion you hear from people. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, obviously crying and sorrow isn't the only relevant experience or emotion to feel. And I wish we would judge games for the ludic components of them.
Yeah. Yeah, my gosh. Yeah, I completely relate to that in slightly other ways. I don't know, when you were at film school, did you ever come across ideas about the cinema of attractions?
No.
That's an idea that I love, and I'll try not to derail our entire conversation about this, but it's about those kind of primal attraction-based elements in a film. So the kinetics, the colours, the tricks, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And that's that visual, mm-hmm. that kind of, I mean, we're reducing it by saying visual, but
yeah,
it's those things, if you like, that aren't narrative. And people often use narrative as being the measure of quality in films, and that's what bugs me. And the example that I wheel out for anyone, which I'll do now, is Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. I love that film, and I showed it to students, you know, on a Blu-ray in the theater, you know, in the viewing theater at uni. And really, that scale, when I had first seen it at that scale, I realized what a disjunctive thing it was and how amazing it was. And that's when things started really falling into place for me. And if you think about it in terms of narrative, it's wafer thin. You know, Dracula, especially in cinema, is kind of wafer thin. But if you think about it in terms of the attractions, that film, you know, all of the stuff going on, it's just off the scale. So I think exactly what you're talking about, these where we place our value judgments about different art forms, I think is really a key thing. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, people think that narrative is where emotion is, but there's all sorts of work about how just colors, sound, smells actually trigger emotion. So, you know, it seems like there's something that needs to be worked out a bit
more.
So
absolutely.
Do carry on. Yeah.
I suppose a part of that comes from the idea of remediation. You know, you look at books, and then films came along, and people were like, we just transforming books into films. And you kind of start analyzing books by the values of films. I suppose that's the same thing that happened to video games as well, where we don't have that language. You know, the academics have that language, and I've studied it, and it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. And so you have this disconnect where the ideas by which we judge video games in pop culture kind of just devolve to comparing it to cinema,
mm-hmm.
Which I can't blame people for, absolutely. But I think there's a lot of interesting ideas when it comes to, you know, gameplay and how we interface with the system, and how the system, you know, constrains our actions, how it influences our actions, and how we can influence the system.
Mm. So how do tabletop games or role playing games fit into that? How did they become something that you wanted to look at more, or were you always playing those as well as the video games?
Yeah, I was always. I started playing Dungeons and Dragons, obviously, when I was about 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always been there. And I think I went to do a master's, and I've just finished my master's in new media, which is all about remediating you know, paper and books with interactivity and connectivity. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of potential to make something really interesting. So my master's dissertation was about approaching failure in video games by taking inspiration from role-playing games. And then again, coming back to Scum and Villainy, the dice roll system where you, I believe, you know, 1, 2, or 3 is just a hard failure. 4 and a 5 is a success with consequences. And then a 6 is just a straight success. And there's something interesting in the way that that system gives you XP for attempting to do desperate and dangerous things. So I do find there's, if you scroll down Twitter and the kind of systems matter discourse is very vitriolic most of the time. But I do think there's something interesting in the way that systems influence the way we interact with stories.
Yeah, I mean, that topic, you know, that you're talking about there, the failure is really interesting because, you know, I'm not a video game player by any stretch of the imagination, and it's certainly been many years since I really even tried properly. But yeah, the way that failure is baked in has none of the nuance that is, you know, so predominant in role-playing games.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very, very black and white. You know, you die is really the one main means of failure in most video games. And I think I don't want to get into my dissertation too much because it's I don't know if it's very relevant, but we start approaching kind of very political analyses of how we construct our stories.
I totally agree. My take on all of that is that kind of apparatus theory stuff, where if you're aware to some degree of the systems in play behind the fiction or the show or whatever it is, you're able to take some power from that. You have some added agency. And that's what I particularly like about role-playing games, that shuttling between the system, the rule system, and the fictional play. So for me, metagaming is something I love to hate. This idea that you shouldn't be just talking around the table and conferring with each other, strategizing and so on. I love that.
That's a funny one most of the time, because I think I personally want to engage. I think this is coming just from my academic background. I want to engage the game as a game. And I think some people want to engage the role-playing side of things, which is, you know, absolutely fair. And I think when you're presented with Dungeons and Dragons, knowing how much HP a monster has is a kind of throwaway bit of information to have access to as a player, I think, because the drama comes from how do you address that? What do you do in response to that? Having your DM kind of step around exact HP numbers, I think, doesn't really add anything to the experience. But that's my personal take on that.
Yeah, that's a funny one. Yeah, the hit points thing. Yeah, I don't like to keep it a secret, but I don't always mention it straight away. I suppose.
Yeah, to be fair, I'm the same when I DM as well. The kind of peek behind the curtain, I suppose, of you want to keep that suspension of disbelief. I suppose that we are actually fighting a dragon rather than doing, you know, maths around the table.
Yeah. So this title, Filmmakers Without Cameras, where exactly did that come from, and what are you saying with that? I know you've kind of talked a bit about this just now, but but what is that? What does that suggest?
Yeah, the idea for that came from a criticism that's levied against Hideo Kojima quite often, who holds that kind of auteur title in video games, because his video games are very cutscene heavy, And so people say, you know, I think Metal Gear Solid, one of his games from however many years ago it came out now, won a Guinness record for the longest cutscene in a video game. And I believe it was about 1 hour 45.
My God.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, that's the length of the feature film. And that was just about 7 hours worth of cutscenes in the entire game. And so, yeah, people levy that criticism of like, dude, just get a camera. What are you doing? But I think that's a little bit incongruous with what I've been saying earlier, in that we shouldn't be approaching video games in the way that we approach films, but there's nothing wrong with doing that, I think. Because ultimately it all tells a story. And I think that's what Filmmakers Without Camera is. It's about how these stories are told and how people personally react to them. When I look for contributors for filmmakers, I say, you know, we want personal stories. I'm not looking for people who are writing about our video game writers or film writers by trade. I want to speak to people who have, you know, a wealth of outside experience to write about those things. Shigeru Miyamoto, when he made Pikmin, was inspired by, you know, the time he spent as a gardener. Disco Elysium was written by communist activists coming out of Estonian, coming out of Estonia, a post-communist state. Yeah, I just wanted to reflect the kind of wealth of experiences that the creators have by inviting people who don't tend to write about those things to write about them.
Casting a wide net rather than a very closed one.
Yeah, absolutely. And, the issue with that then becomes that people who aren't writers by trade are quite reluctant to write about things. And so that's been one of our main challenges, really. Because people say, I've never written a long form piece about what I think.
yeah.
But just try and encourage people, I suppose.
I still do from time to time write academic stuff, and I love the podcasting for the fact that it's not all of that. It's conversational, and it's off the cuff. It's a much nicer way, I feel, of recording my thoughts now, having gone through all of that process before.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you, did you mention you teach as well?
I have lectured and I teach English here in Germany. I keep my research going. One thing I wrote about was the Esper, the stop frame Esper scene in Blade Runner, for example, when it goes into the photograph. I've written some stuff about Disney. All sorts of bits and pieces. Flickr films as well. Avant-garde Flickr films too. Paul Sharitz. But also, you know, and applying an Althusserian model to that, if that means anything to you. So,
not particularly, to be honest.
Like, that's...
Althusserian.
Louis Althusser was one of the... I don't know if he would call himself a post-structuralist, but he was one of those French Marxist critics in the 1960s. But lots of very interesting ideas. A very complicated guy, but all sorts of interesting stuff there. You know, it can get very intense, and that's very nice, and that's very good. But you know, the gaming offers something else, doesn't it? So Filmmakers Without Cameras, we've got attention to film, we've got political critique, mm-hmm. and we've got gaming. And I mean, are you, do you want to kind of keep them bouncing off each other, or kind of equally represent them? Or are you trying to encourage some combination of them in the thoughts, or can things just move freely around all of them? And maybe I've missed a couple of nodes or points in that constellation.
Mostly it's free flowing for now.
Yeah.
For now. Yeah. My partner and I, when I started issue one, it was, like I said, you know, my neighbors and people immediately around me. And we saw, you know, a moderate amount of success. £1,000 is quite good for something that literally, like I said, I used as a means of applying for a job. And I didn't even apply for the job at the end. And then with issue two, we raised £1,500 in the first 24 hours of our fundraising campaign. And again, this was just a continuation of something that I do on the side, but it has quickly grown into, and because I was doing it on the side, it was just, you know, a platform for people I knew, really. It was a free flowing collection of work. And now I think because we're starting to see a lot more success, I'm going to have to start thinking about themes. And yeah, constraints, I think.
So
it's interesting. My partner is studying curation now. And so it becomes this interesting question of what does this magazine say as a collection of pieces together? Where right now it's very eclectic and almost directionless, but we do have, by virtue of being very left-leaning, the people that I surround myself with, the people that I have access to, share that. And so I think there is, in terms of direction, FWC does lean towards political critique, and a little bit of I don't want to say anti-hegemonist work, anti-hegemonic even. But I would like to think that it will do more in the future.
Sure. So, as editor and as designer of them, what are the differences then between issue one and issue two?
I think where issue one was very much learning to walk, with issue two, we're kind of leaping now. It has, issue one was 40 pages. Issue two will be over 80 pages. We're doing a hardback version, and myself as an editor and a designer, I feel like I've made that same kind of journey where issue one was me learning how to put text to a page. But issue two, I've spent a lot of time investing in learning about layout design as an art form and using that to reflect what the essays say as well.
Equally, what appeals to me about Filmmakers Without Cameras as well in terms of gaming is, you know, that it's indicating, like you were saying about thinking about films out beyond the scope of film studies, I think it also pulls in more wider influences than just in the gaming world. And of course there are lots of wonderful people doing similar kinds of things as well, and I think the more we do that, the healthier it all is, especially in terms, like you're saying, that perhaps we stop making such simple comparisons with film or literature, and we perhaps also start drawing more influence from other forms of art, and so on. And when that gets linked with the shifting types of games and settings that we're getting, I think all of that points to something very, very healthy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think I want to preface this by saying I don't mean to slag off all of my film school peers, but I think what film school lacked in some ways, there was a big focus on the craft. This is how you use the camera, etc. And there was a lot less effort paid to the art side of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And I think video game courses are seeing the same issue,
mm-hmm.
where you you go to university and you just learn how to do the thing, but not why you're doing the thing. And so I think, and I am a media student now, so
mm-hmm.
I am biased, but I do think we lack a kind of culture and media studies focus in most practical courses. I feel like that's a big statement to make.
I remember one student being quite vocally, being quite vocal, complaining about doing a close analysis of a scene,
mm-hmm.
In order to understand how it was funny. Which I think is really valuable, and I'm really pleased that young person spoke up. But I was trying to make the point that comedy films aren't automatically funny. They're funny because they've been put together in a particular way. And so there's that intersection of critical thinking and the craft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they become a really important cultural artifact as well. Things that we found funny in the past, obviously not very funny these days.
Well, indeed. I'd love to know a bit more about your gaming habits.
Mm-hmm.
You've talked about Scum and Villainy, and I think you mentioned something else, which has just completely left my mind. But what maybe especially over the last year or so with the pandemic, how have you been playing? What have your groups been like, and what kinds of things have you been doing, and have you been homebrewing anything? Or
my groups, so my main group, my friends from university, we play Dungeons and Dragons most weekly, almost. And we've had a funny journey in that I introduced them to Dungeons and Dragons several years ago. And while it's still the game of choice for our group, I used to DM, I'm not the DM anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I have fully gone off the deep end in terms of like the indie RPG scene. And I've gone off a little bit of D&D. I know that the others, still very much appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm here in the corner like, why don't we try Wonder Home? Something so radically different to D&D.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, when I was short on money as a student a few years ago, I started, I put myself out there as a quote unquote professional dungeon master.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had, moderate success. I've had a few recurring groups who I've been playing with for, more than 2 years, kind of about once a month. And so we've played Dungeons and Dragons with one and Scum and Villainy with the other.
Mm.
And that's why I've enjoyed it so much.
Mm. Mm. And do you feel that the page GMing is markedly different from the hobby group gaming, if I may call it that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's different. No, there is a little bit more pressure obviously, but I think the groups, you know, I've had several one-off groups,
mm-hmm.
who left great reviews, who are really happy, and that's great, and that was kind of my business model.
Mm-hmm.
That I will, you know, you show up with your friends, and I will run you, you know, one game, show you what it's about, you know, get mm-hmm. you all the good stuff, the social stuff, the combat stuff, etc. Mm-hmm. And then some groups started coming back, and I think at that point it becomes difficult. again, like I said, I'm a systems person, and so that one repeatable session, you know, I can market that and say I can do this over and over again because I know it off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But once you have people coming in and taking these things in their own directions, that makes the pay not worth it. Really, really not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it takes me a long time to think about role-playing games, which I don't mind doing if it's with my friends. But once it starts becoming a regular thing, I can see why people do this as a living, full time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Interesting. Cause I'm just finishing a project, which is an exchange project between Germany and Wales. It's for young people. Mm-hmm. And we got funding from both sides. And so we've been getting paid to run the project and to run games.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end, we're going to publish the work that the group has done, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of has a different model, which I'm really pleased about, because it allows me to do more paid gaming work,
mm-hmm.
And at the same time has a kind of aim, has this aim to it, and I suppose I'm not solely responsible for all of it all of the time, or there's not that perceived. I mean, at the same time, God, you know, I'm coordinating the project with my collaborators. So in some ways it's even more work. So I'll just stop talking about that. But yeah, no, it's really interesting. It's really interesting if you have a certain aptitude for these kind of events or experiences, you know, running games, what you do with it. And some people are really staunch, aren't they, about it's a hobby, you know, no money changes hands.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is a tough hurdle to overcome. I you know, the commie in my heart says, yeah, absolutely, no money, money's bad, but also bills need to be paid, and yeah. Well, you know, I know that having a group that plays, used to play weekly, I mean, we still do most of the time, it is an investment, you know, and mm-hmm. I think it feels less bad to ask people for the money when, you know, I'm paying for Foundry, I'm paying for my mm-hmm. Amazon Web Services to host it, you know, I'm mm-hmm. paying for D&D Beyond, obviously my time. And you know, the kind of stress-free experience of like, yeah, you sit down, you have a couple of drinks, and mm-hmm. I'm gonna handle the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's not, you know, that's not a terrible value proposition, I don't think.
Well, you see the model that I've tried to switch into mm-hmm. is that for certain, you know, for things, for certain projects or whatever, I would like to be paid for my time. My existential time. You know, I'm alive for a certain amount of time, and for certain projects I would like to be fairly, you know, paid for that. But I'm not looking for some kind of massive score or anything.
Absolutely.
So I think it remains in that kind of egalitarian zone, precisely, you know, like what you're talking about. You've got certain costs.
And I suppose you can have that very academic conversation of parasocial relationships and, you know, how real is it when money starts exchanging hands, like who has the power in this relationship? But I have been invited to two weddings.
Wow.
as a result of these games. So okay. I think they've gone a bit past pure kind of labor exchange value.
You're talking about good power now, aren't we? We're talking about the power of good.
I meant like an employee versus employer, but yeah.
But I presume you weren't invited to the weddings to run games. This was as a result of having
just
run
making
them.
Friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good. And I think the older I get, these things seem less complicated somehow. Interesting, very interesting. And maybe could we kind of, you know, sidle up towards perhaps the end of this discussion with some of your insights about crowdfunding? I mean, you know, we've just talked about money and the hobby and the gaming and all of that. What have you got any tips for people who might be, you know, going in for crowdfunding in future?
It's a difficult one, because a part of that, looking at my current Kickstarter analytics, I can see that Twitter is the main source of most of the money. And it's really community driven, obviously, you know, that's why it's called crowdfunding, but there is, let me think how to say this. There are lots of RPG communities online, and there's always that fine line of, you know, going somewhere to promote yourself and, you know, becoming part of a community in which you will promote yourself later down the line. And I think that, you know, just making yourself known, just saying hi to people, just saying, engaging with people on Discords, you know, unfortunately forums are mainly dying out, and so we're stuck with Discord. But going to those Discords and talking to people seems like the most efficient way of raising money. And again, yeah, that becomes a very uncomfortable conversation of parasocial relationships and using people, I think. But that might just be my kind of overly active conscience talking.
I mean, it's fascinating. It's fascinating what you're saying. And I think that can certainly be true. I was going to crowdfund a game in the last Zine Quest. And for various reasons, I didn't include it in Zine Quest in the end. The one key thing was I felt like it's not a zine, it's a game. And then I saw some of the other zines that were being produced and I thought, oh, okay.
Yeah, Zine Quest is a kind of a terrifying time.
Yeah. But you know, but I was a little bit involved in it all, primarily through Facebook, I suppose. And I thought the interactions between people were really good, and that kind of community support thing is quite astounding. Where, you know, people would post something and say, hey, nearly, you know, 95% of all the registered Zine Quest projects have funded. This one's struggling a little bit. Can everyone do something? And then they did. And
I think
with the pricing, you can kind of see the difference between the cottage industrialists and the strategic publishers or whatever. And of course, the irony being that it seems like the strategic publishers score much bigger successes.
It's kind of frustrating that they're making the move to Kickstarter as a funding platform when they very definitely have got the money to do it themselves.
But then it has this interesting thing, doesn't it, where it functions quite like an efficient pre-order system. And there's so many products, aren't there, that you could come up with something and it just sits there. Maybe you've got something to say about this. I think that opportunity that pledgers, backers have to influence or shape the publications a little bit, I think is quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think there are some more or less creative approaches to that, but that seems to me quite different to just thinking you as a publisher you've got it done, publishing that thing, and then expecting people to just agree,
just buy it.
So I don't know if you've got anything to say about that feeling of interaction with the stretch goals or the pledge levels or...
Yeah, I mean, stretch goals are a funny one because, again, money talk, I hate it. But, I made the promise to all of my contributors that we will share the profits of the Kickstarter with you. Everybody gets an even share. Mm-hmm. And so... you look at something like the Free League Kickstarters or the Avatar Kickstarter that has just wrapped up, that have, 30-odd stretch goals. And you think, as an independent, I don't think people are expecting me to do that, but also you look at that and you think, absolutely no way in hell can I... could I also do that?
Sure.
And so I've gotten a growing appreciation of the campaigns that are just... once we reach our goal, that's it. Our initial funding goal was to pay people fairly well. This is what we're making and that's it. And everything we raise over the total is, going to contributors or put it away for the next project, something like that. Mm-hmm. But I must say, scrolling down the backer list, during this project and seeing repeating names is an absolutely priceless feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Because... these, more often than not, a couple of these people have reached out to me after the first issue being like, I really enjoyed this. What about, have you tried doing this? Try doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so like you said, there is absolutely that relationship that you can foster with people and people appreciate because it's always nice to see that someone is, paying attention to the things that you make and seeing them return and see the fruit of that is, as a creative, better than anything, really.
Sure. You get the feeling that you're doing something right.
Yeah, absolutely. We're all just part of the capitalist rat race to burn the planet as quickly as possible.
Well, again, I think this in trying for myself to come to terms with some of these things, that partly getting older, partly just wanting to do things I want to do, and especially in connection with gaming. I think, so this idea, I would like to be paid for my time. Not so much for anything else. With that comes the thought that in asking or in getting a certain amount of money for something, is that something transformative? And then I feel like that was money well spent. Like my time was well spent doing something productive. If I was doing something that was not trying to transform things or change things a little bit, or think of alternative funding structures, mm-hmm. and so on, then I wouldn't have such a good feeling about it. But I feel okay about that. For example, and I give full credit to a good friend of mine. With this project with the young people in Germany and Wales, we made sure that we have funding to pay them all a little bit as co-authors on the project. So there's this kind of professionalizing element to the project where, you know, we're going to publish it digitally. It will be freely available to people, and they will have got paid for their contributions. Mm-hmm. So, and that I think chimes with what you're saying, where you've decided to split the money with the contributors in a sense. And yeah, so I think those kind of approaches are important, instead of just thinking, okay, we're going to do this, and laugh all the way home.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm really glad that Kickstarter offers these opportunities, and I've been able to pay the contributors fairly. Mm-hmm. I think that matters to me right now above all, because you know, the job market in the UK is absolutely dog shit. So I also get paid an even share of the Kickstarter money, which is considerably less than if I was working somewhere and making this, I would expect. And so obviously the primary benefit being that, everybody that I'm working with is doing something good and earning something for their craft. And I'm just coming out with a portfolio piece that I can hopefully use to get a job doing something that I like. Mm-hmm. But that's the kind of harsh reality of it. I think if I had set a goal to pay myself for the time that I spent doing this, you know, we would be in the...
Well, yeah. So when I talk about getting paid for my time, I'm not necessarily talking about it being it being a kind of representative or logical payment for it. Yeah,
but I'm unlike some of my artist friends, I'm lucky enough to have a stable job that lets me... Now, it doesn't give me that much free time, but it gives me enough free time to do this.
Absolutely. So it's not... Free time. Free time is the key thing. That's the thing I keep coming back to. Absolutely. We have to protect free time. Mm. So Filmmakers Without Cameras, is it issue or volume two?
Issue
two. That's on Kickstarter now. So people can back it now. Will it be available in print afterwards?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now it will definitely be available at Rux Press, who Oz, who runs Rux, is amazing. Mm-hmm. You should definitely check out Rux Press. All kinds of RPG, small RPG content. And then we will also go to... So I've been in talks with a Travelling Man in Manchester, but they are... I don't think they focus on that kind of stuff as much. Colours May Vary, I believe, in Leeds will stock it. Exalted Funeral in the US will stuck it. And there are a few I've forgotten, but you know, if you Google it, there's definitely going to be a website. There is a website with a list of everywhere that's going to be available in print.
Super, super. And any plans for issue 3?
Yeah, absolutely. I hope so. I'm going to, I submitted my dissertation.
Yeah.
And then I went straight into the Kickstarter for issue 2.
Yeah.
So once it's out, I'm going to take a day off because I desperately need it.
Yeah, just a day.
Just a single one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good for you.
And then we'll think about issue 3, but definitely considering the support for issue 2 that we've had so far.
Super, super.
I'd love to.
I've got my last questions about the Ludic Behemoth. Do you have any more thoughts or things that you'd like to say before I turn to the Behemoth?
I don't think so.
Super.
I think we've covered so many different topics.
Yeah.
I'm
Okay. So when I started the podcast, I thought it would be good fun to invoke a Ludic Behemoth. And so this is some kind of super entity. And I ask my guests to offer something, a value, an offering to them or to it. There are two things that I ask people to offer. And it's an underrated character archetype or skill and a game mechanism or component.
Ooh. Underrated character archetype or skill. Ooh, let me think about what I played recently.
And you could, of course, take all of these, take them with a bit of a pinch of salt. You can twist them to your will.
I don't know why my mind immediately went to the 5th edition Druid level 20 skill.
Right.
Which means that you age a year for every 5 years that you live, I believe.
Okay.
So I offer that. I offer long life.
Long life. Okay. So basically, instead of you only age 1 year, but it's been 5 years.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Yeah. Right.
And it's in the kind of design system of 5th edition, it's an absolutely useless skill, but it enables something greater, I think, a long-lasting campaign so that you hopefully can retire your character and have them come back at some point in the future.
Nice. Very nice. And the other offering is a game mechanism or component.
I'm going to have to say the resolution mechanics from Forged in the Dark. Make desperate actions. Try and live with failure. Failure is not the end. It's merely a stepping stone to success. And what is failure? Capitalism tells us it's like not making money and like not getting married, but
what do RPGs tell us it is then?
Oh, making lots of money. Yeah.
Yeah, super, super. Yeah, for me, when I'm GMing, I love character failures or even NPC failures because they tip games here and there, and I think maybe there's more to be drawn on in terms of perhaps players. As a player myself, for players to run with that failure. Some people do very well, and other people Don't.
I think we've got the kind of play culture around fifth edition right now where you want your character to, you know, go from zero to hero and be successful and fight off evil. And I wish we kind of embraced that OSR type of play a little bit more, where you make risky choices and deal with, you know, your character might fall down the pit, pit of snakes, and that's okay.
I have done that. A halfling fell to its death in a misty corridor. All good. Thank you ever so much, Eric, and I hope that you'll come back on at some point in the future to talk about other things that you're up to.
Yeah, I would love to. I've thoroughly enjoyed this. Thank you.
Super. Thanks a lot.